der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Record. Does it record? It's recording. Welcome to the already 22nd episode of the Hurra Hurra Podcast. And as you, dear listeners, hear right now, this is again in English language. And it's, I think, the third in a row. So I hope you're still comfortable with it. And if not, then please send me an email or write me via Instagram. I might flip over to some German episodes again. I made me a link. Yeah, feedback. This is something that is really welcome. After the last episode already, some messages came in. And to introduce myself, my name is Christian Zöllner. I'm a professor at the Burg-Giebichenstein Art University in Halle, Germany. And I run this podcast as a follow-up to a festival that we did on design education back in 2019. And today, so end of editor's note, and today my guest here in this like little talk recording is Ramon Tejeda. And Ramon Tejeda came across my like viewport on Instagram, and there he brought into my feed topics of decolonization, equality in design, representation in design, and all that. I call it stuff, but don't want to be impolite. And I was very, very curious about that and about the person behind that Red 93 account. So I'm very happy to have Ramon Tejeda here in the podcast. And I want to ask you, Ramon, to introduce yourself, because I think you can do it better than I might ever do.
Thank you, Christian. Oh my God, introduce myself. So my name is Ramon Tejeda, and I'm a designer, teacher, person who likes to talk to other people, designers. And I have what I consider at this point in my career, like this hybrid design teaching questioning practice, which I've labeled puncturing, or an act of puncturing, which pretty much is about finding myself in design and spending so much time as a designer, not seeing myself reflected in design. So my goal these days is to make sure that students like me, people like me, designers like me, who are interested in design, graphic design, see themselves reflected and their ideas and valued. So, and I also teach at Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, Rhode Island, in the graphic design department. So that's sort of, I guess that covers it a little bit. I'm never one to be like big introduction to myself. I always like, everybody's like, what's your bio? And I give them like a 2-line bio.
Human.
Yeah, human being.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you say people like me. And I want to be really honest that it's difficult for me to say people like, who is people like you? Like if you refer to that.
Yeah, so, you know, these days you hear the term BIPOC. You know, I was born in the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean, which is the little island also known as Hispaniola, if you pronounce the H, and it's where Christopher Columbus landed when he quote unquote discovered the New World. So, you know, it's sort of like where the idea of colonialism began on the American continent. So it went from an island of an indigenous population of the Taínos that pretty much got slaughtered. Everything disappeared. I think there's like 0.01% left of Taínos in the Caribbean, to an island that was mixed primarily of Spaniards and enslaved Africans that were brought in to work on sugar canes. So now, you know, fast forward 500 years, what you have is a culture that is a very vibrant culture of descendants of African enslaved peoples and Spaniards primarily. So what that, you know, like, and that brings all kinds of complications. And then I grew up in New York City because I left the Dominican Republic when I was very small. I grew up in New York City with immigrant parents, the American dream, people who moved to the US from the global south, the Caribbean, and they want a better life for their kids. And then in New York City, you know, there's a lot of people that look like me. There's a lot of kids that are Afro-Caribbean. There are a lot of kids that are Black kids. There's a lot of, you know, one of the most diverse cities in the world. Yet ultimately, when I started to deal with school, I'm thinking about what I was going to do. I was entering fields where I was kind of the only person in the room that looked like me, even though I was living in a city that was incredibly diverse. But who is, you know, when I got to design, who is a designer and what design looks like rarely reflected anything to do with like my everyday reality or like who was, you know, reflected my parents, for example. You know, like I'm very obsessed right now with like bringing the voice of my parents into the work, or like how do they see themselves reflected? It's sort of like an homage to them, but also like these people have ideas that we just haven't listened to because, you know, they don't have a pedigree of a design degree. My parents didn't go to school for a long time, right? So they're supposedly uneducated. They don't speak the language. They don't, you know, all of that stuff. They don't have that visual vocabulary that designers supposedly have. I question whether we actually have it or whether we just sort of said, oh, this works for us or for certain people, or it works in certain contexts and that's how it's going to work. So when I mean like people like me, I mean, you know, like the fact that, you know, you could go in a design classroom and, you know, a lot of kids of color don't see themselves in the literature, in the theory, in the ideas. You know, you have a history of design book and it spends, you know, 7,000 pages talking about, you know, the Renaissance in Europe, and then like two sentences on like Africa, half a sentence on like South America, a quarter of a sentence, you know, on, I don't know, somebody else, and like, you know, one page on Asian design, and then 7,000 pages on the glory of like, you know, like the Bauhaus or or like, you know, like the way that, you know, like the way that certain very privileged people sort of saw the world and then like sort of were privileged enough to be able to write it, and like all of a sudden that became the standards.
Yeah.
By the way, you'll probably hear a lot of knocks on the Bauhaus because there are things about it that I like. People always think that I'm like, oh, you really? I'm like, no, I actually like it, but I have a lot of questions about it.
Perfect.
And that's the thing to me, the questioning of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And you've been sending me a bit of material, and I was reading it, and I came a lot along this this word canon or kanon, as we say it in German, and by reading it, and that happens to me lately a lot of time when it comes to depatriarchized design and decolonized design, that I feel very touched because I don't know the right expression. I feel kind of ashamed or something, that because like I'm like, yeah, I'm right in the center of the canon, like I'm a man, I'm white, I'm in the center of Europe, and I have a lot of privilege in this thing that I can see myself in this 7,000 words, like on very, very many pages, and that I never questioned that. It's something that the shame comes on that point, that I think, hey, how old am I? I'm nearly 40, and I just never really thought about this, because like I was so much into that wide Bauhausy, a bit Werkbund, a bit like Morris, a bit like UK. Then okay, let's look into Scandinavia, you know, like, and then so I take myself a lot of time back in this thing, and and really see, look where I have questions. And one question is here, from, and I want to hear it from, I ask you if you would like to tell me, what is your, what are your questions on the Bauhaus in that case?
Yeah, so before I get, I mean, yeah, some of them, I think part of what we all need to do, and I think part of what I think it's really exciting to see people are doing, is sort of stepping back and engaging in the conversations, and honestly wanting to engage in the conversation, but also sort of saying, being able to reflect and see, right? And say, wait a minute, why didn't I ask those? Like, I love how you said, like, why didn't I ask those questions, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so easy in fields. I myself didn't ask these questions until fairly recently, to be honest with you, right? Because what the field itself has the narrative of the field itself has been a very particular narrative, right? And we all just go into it. And then one day you either hit your head against it or you sort of like do, or you bounce out of it or however. And you know, like it's really interesting because designers are always like, we're so political. Designers are so political. I'm like, political about what? Because if we really were political, we should have been having this conversation about 15, 20, 30, 50 years ago, right? Like the civil rights movement in the US was hugely influential all over the world, but it seems like design just decided to be like, oh, okay, we're just gonna like wave today and then keep going. I think a lot of the questions that I've, and okay, so I've lived in Europe, okay? So I'm totally like, people are like, well, you don't really like it. I'm like, that's not that I don't like it. It's like, I'm asking questions. Like, I wanna know. Or we can engage in the conversation. So the Bauhaus has become like this big sort of shrine to design, like the Bauhaus. I mean, like, I don't understand why there's 7,000 books about the Bauhaus every year. Like, I don't. I know that it was 100th anniversary. I kept making fun. I'm like, another book about the Bauhaus? There's nothing we don't know about the Bauhaus at this point of the game. Like, we've known it, okay? So can we move and spin off of it? Can we sort of let it be there? And say, you know what? We don't need another book about the Bauhaus. What we need is another book about African designers. And we need to find people that can do that, not like helicopter into Africa and then do the designer thing of like, oh, we know what we're doing, and then putting it back. Or even worse, taking their content and plugging it into some like universal style book that like pretends to organize things in a way that makes no sense. My question about the Bauhaus is that I just want to know why their wives were in the basement. I want to know their why their wives were in the basement. Why were the women in the basement? I mean, to me, and you know, this is my own taste, it's like Annie Albers will forever and ever be way more interesting than Joseph. And I don't want to know why she was what she was considered like lesser art. I'm like, problematic. There were also like issues. They were very particular people. I think there's some things around the personalities that nowadays to us are jarringly problematic. Right, so like, I think that we have to ask those questions. I also think that it's decontextualized a lot of the times. It's just, oh, it's the Bauhaus. But a lot of the times we're not really engaging in like how it became that, why it became that, why in that particular geographical space, in that particular geographical context, that was appropriate. Versus perhaps those ideas were not as functional or appropriate or necessary in other places, in other parts of the world. Instead, what we got was like, well, this is it. This is really good. This works for everybody or parts of it. And then we're just going to export it all over the place, right? And part of it was that, you know, a lot of them, you know, left Germany and had to escape, you know, unfortunately, and then they shared it. And I also think that some of them, yeah, they wanted to share their knowledge and their ideas and how they saw the world. And then perhaps the design media and the powers that be that sort of create that canon sort of framed it that way. So like what we get now is like this, like this is the way where perhaps it should be, this is one of the ways, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that teaching students, I think this is one of the things that I think a lot of us teachers are doing now is making that shift from like, this is the way to saying, this is one of the ways. We can model that for you. And then you have the agency to think about where are you coming from? How are you coming to this? What are your visual references? Like what was at home? Like where did you grow up? Like what were you listening to and hearing? What was your grandmother telling you? What are those stories or the ways they saw that perhaps allows you to create your own sort of like way of looking at the world and outputting design or art through that lens.
And you say, looking into the world, and that comes in like coming back to design practice, into creating mm-hmm. your own visual language and your own visual references. And then I think also that that this is very important nowadays acknowledge that that certain people have their own I'm really, really careful in saying it, but let's call it like a their own historic, like own biographical style. Like it comes with their heritage and with their own way of doing. Like I'm East German, you know. I have not big problems with the Western or West German design scene, but it's us and it's them in a way. So it came together, but still it's a difference.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we all have variations. Like we see the world differently, right? There's no universe, like the idea of like universal design. I'm like, oh my God, can we just kill that idea? It doesn't exist. Like mm-hmm. most of us individually, even if we come from the same places, we look at things differently. We understand them differently. We read them differently. And so much of that is depending on like how we grew up, what we were exposed to, what we were not exposed to, what like our, again, our parents, our families, the neighborhood, like your neighbors, your teachers, what they exposed you to. So acknowledging that, but I'm really into sort of thinking of like making for mom and dad or your grandparents, right? Like I'm thinking like, how does that shift your perspective if you really value and privilege like that knowledge that comes out of a localized context, right? Like what your grandparents know, what your neighborhood knows, right? Like if you grew up in a different, with a different cultural perspective than the sort of like established, you know, like patriarchal normal like world that we've developed, how does like bringing that out and valuing that, which I think design in the past perhaps hasn't been so open about, and that has been seen and or viewed and or critiqued in, if we talk about an academic space, as like, that is not good. That is not valuable. Yet you find designers that will see that once in a while or take a trip, take some pictures, and then they go and make a pattern, and all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, popular and diverse. It's like, no, you just went and stole somebody's ideas. But I think it's a very easy thing for designers to do because that's how we were all trained for so long. Right? Like we were just not asking that question. We were asking some questions, but not those questions, I would argue.
Yeah, three things. Just make a note, second. And fashion, so. One thing, ranting about universal design. It's okay because,
I love laughing about it, to be honest with you. I think it's part of it is like, it's comical. So like, I think it's, we can joke but about
as,
it too.
But as you've been talking about, it's, and my question was, okay, where does that mindset of a universal design come from? And maybe, I mean, the intents of the people doing it are good. They do want to do good, but they follow. I have to talk about people who are into this universal design thing and ask them what they say, like going into that conversation too, but they're not in the place. So let's take this for granted. They follow a capitalistic idea of efficiency. Like,
right.
Okay, one has to fit everybody. It's universal. It goes for me. Yeah. It goes for you too. You cannot blame me. I gave my best to give it to you because it works for me. And that comes from that Bauhaus thing. Okay, working for the masses, doing things one time in one model and then multiplying it to a great industrial extent to bring it all over the place and let people benefit from your genius idea. And that is, it sounds so harsh, but in the end, if you watch it from that kind of charity perspective, but from that critical imperialistic point of view, it starts to become very critical. And as you say, and what I find very interesting is that going away from that global perspective, that a global, it's not global design, it's universal design. It's like what comes after that, and the pluriverse, I know, but still, that you have the global thing, and the idea of impacting in that great extent is sheer impossible. You know, you cannot, you can't. But as you say, working for mom and dad like people is something where you have to go back to local and where you can identify impact. And that is very interesting. And that is realer than a hypothetical impact through universal design, is it?
Right. Well, I interested you as a hypothetical because, I mean, think about like in design practices, how many times we talk about clients, you know, like these weird words that we use, like, I don't know, avatars, like weird, like you know, study that studies who the audience is going to be. You never hear like the specific person. Like I always had real issues when I would be given assignments or projects where like, let's make a persona. And then like you put together like this weird face of the person that this was supposed. I'm like, I don't know who this is. Like, how can you make like that? And I think that we just got into this thing that like we could, but it also put us in a position like we are designers. We know how to make things look good. We know how to translate things. We know some things. We don't know everything. We haven't read everything. Most we probably have all read too many design books, right? Like we probably needed to read other things, but we like literally spent, I personally spent way too much money on big ginormous books of designers' works that would just like homage to like somebody's genius idea. And with all due respect to people that have genius ideas, that's fantastic. But it's like turning that into like this hero worshiping situation, which I think it's part of the problem is like, that doesn't really do anything. Like that's, you have a great idea, you have a good idea, you have a fantastic idea at times, but your idea also completely falls apart when it's decontextualized out of this sort of like model of like capitalistic design. Like it falls apart. It doesn't work because it doesn't work for some people. Like it doesn't work for, I would argue sometimes the majority of people, right? Like I think a lot of design for the majority of the population of the world, a lot of design just makes no sense. Like what we value, what we put in like the canon, what we put in those books. And I think that we all had, you know, like I don't take myself out of it because I certainly as a student, like, I mean, I just love those Mila Brockman posters. I still love the Mila Brockman posters. Like, oh my God, yes, I would be the one that would buy a Mila Brockman poster if I could get a hold of one that wasn't $1 million, you know, but I can look at it in a different way now. And before I just wasn't really looking at it critically. I was just looking at it, this is good. This is the apex of design. This is what I need to aspire to. You know, like I need to aspire to use a sans serif that supposedly has no politics, that is neutral. I'm like, what is neutral about that typeface? There's nothing neutral about it. It's completely like the opposite of it. So, I just think that a lot of it has to do with like, how do we just like, start to think about that, use the word local. I keep finding myself saying local, 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 because I think that's where we are in sort of this space right now with COVID, with all like, at least in the US, with all the social unrest, which also like there are a lot of countries that are having social unrest and that also like sort of we're watching what was happening here this summer, you know, like thinking about dropping in local. And I think before we started recording, I was telling you about Emergent Strategies, Adrienne Marie Brown's book. And Adrienne Marie is in Detroit, Michigan. And when you hear her talk about like being a community activist, what does that mean? What does that mean being a human being that's working with other people in your community rather than like, oh, I'm working for some community that I will never ever meet. Maybe I fly in one time, say hi, and I leave, and then I make some like genius thing. But like the responsibility of actually engaging with your community, right? Like whether that means your immediate tiny little cluster community, or whether that means your little town or your little neighborhood or your like three blocks around your house that all your friends live in, and thinking how what you make involves that community and then expands out, right? And how it can grow, even without you being there. So yeah, if that makes sense.
it somehow makes sense. And but I want to go back to your teaching practice. And yes. And you've been sending me a text, and I think that I really read this, and I'm very thankful for that. And the listeners don't see, but I just like did a lot of like underlining and highlighting things.
I love that. I call that annotation. So I love annotating, like old school books when you like just write all over them.
Yes.
Yeah, I love doing that. Yeah.
So, but you sent me something about decolonizing, and if it's okay for you, I read it, and then I want to ask you a question about it. So it says for me, but it means for Ramon. So I'd say for Ramon. Mm-hmm. For Ramon, yeah. Decolonizing is about making space, sometimes taking space, to allow people that look like him, especially BIPOC, which means black indigenous persons of color people, be active and essential participants around the table. It is about physical visibility, structural change, representation, not tokenism, about acknowledgement, which is underlined, of ideas, land, values that were stolen and repressed, etc. Mm-hmm. About giving up and taking space, about responsible expansion, which means recognizing what design has ignored and not valued, about narratives, point of views, perspectives, stories, theories, ideas, geographical references, and not just Northern European and American lineages, which erases everybody's else identity, and they come to colonialism, a diversity of lineages, not just the Bauhaus and all its grandchildren, etc. It is about unearthing, shifting the glance, and decentering, giving agency, being vulnerable, making mistakes, thinking about his communities, not the design community, thinking about mom, dad, grandparents, your neighbor, our chosen families, acknowledging, not knowing, and making the periphery the center. So this is quite a proper statement. So this is like delivered. And and it's about decolonizing, and you said before that you were teaching decolonizing design, but you stopped that and you would not do it again. Just tell me why.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like it, and there were other, you know, like whenever you have a new job and you go into a place for the first time, you really don't, you know, you need to get a sense of the place. Mm-hmm. When I was hired at RISD, I was hired, and I was asked to do an elective. I was very excited about doing an elective.
What is that?
An elective is sort of like in a department you have a series of classes that are sort of the core classes, mm-hmm. and then you have a group of classes that are called, we use the term elective in the US, which is they rotate and students have access. You know, sometimes you have new faculty coming in or. Mm-hmm. Adjunct faculty that are coming in and teaching like a special class on like, sometimes it's about tools, sometimes it's about theory.
So it's not obligatory, or they don't have to go the student, they can go.
Yeah, and sometimes faculty will develop classes around subject matters that students are like, you know, they're like, we would love for you to do a class about this because we're trying to explore this, right? So, and some, you know, and electives are always really good because they're not just like, they're additional to sort of the main track. I developed this elective around what I was working on, decolonizing design. And I was actually, part of the challenge is that I was wrestling with what it actually meant. The word decolonizing, thank you for reading it, because that definition, I try my best to try to like do the reductive thing. And then one day I realized it cannot be reductive. It needed to be that like ginormous, messy statement. Part of it was that I was wrestling with the term. I was wrestling with what it meant to me, and when in developing the class, which then the reader was part of what I developed for the class, I was just short-circuiting and I didn't know, and then it was challenging a lot. And it was challenging a lot my own self-perception and my own sort of like, there was a lot of imposter syndrome going on when I was teaching that class. I was very uncomfortable because I was actually dealing with some of the issues that I was asking the students to do. I was actually going through it as well, I think, right? Like I was like, what? I'm asking this, what? And there isn't really a way, like, I think a lot of the times people want to be like, what does it look like? Why do we need to know what it looks like? I don't know. Like, it's going to look like a lot of different things. And it all depends on where you're coming from. So that's, I think, part of what I was hoping to get out of that, like, sort of definition. It's really, really, really broad. Like, to me, it's really broad. And it really depends on where you're coming from. If you're coming from the Caribbean, it's going to mean one particular thing. If you're coming from India, it's going to mean a different thing. You're coming from South America, from Africa. If you're Native American or First Nations in Canada, it means a different thing. But what I felt was that I wanted to encompass the whole thing. The class got really wild and messy.
What does it mean?
It became very unstructured. And I think academia has created, at least in the US, this perception that everybody has to have it all together all the time and that it has to be a structure. Mm-hmm. This particular, like, very rigid structure, and you're supposed to know. And it just got very loose. It was probably the most uncomfortable class I've ever taught. But I also think that it is not a class that is like an elective that students get to pick. I think it's an idea that needs to permeate through an entire curriculum, through an entire school, right? Like that idea of we're going to look at multiplicity. We're going to look at different perspectives. We're going to value those perspectives. We're going to put them all in the same steps. There's like a list of steps. I mean, you know, if you really, you know, like, I'm super in awe and inspired by Dean Dory Tunstall at OCAD in Toronto. And Dory is one of like the leaders for a lot of us to go with this.
Dory Tunstall.
Yeah. She's the dean at OCAD, and she like frames this in such a gorgeous way. But you know, it's about creating curriculum or creating spaces in an academic institution that values everybody and the contributions everybody like has given throughout the history, not just like three people. And then everybody else sort of sits back there going like, where am I? Right. And then the potential sort of like damage that it inflicts on students in particular, you know, like, because you don't see yourself reflected, like what happens. And I think we now have enough research of sort of what happens when kids see themselves reflected. You know, I start to think about like President Obama in the US when little boys and black kids started to see themselves, or like even in the inauguration 3 weeks ago when Michelle Obama wore that suit. And then there was that, I don't know if people saw this amazing picture of these two little kids that like had dressed up like them. And like Michelle Obama posted her Instagram, and she's like, and the whole thing was, this is what representation means. That little girl saw Michelle Obama and saw herself reflected. And that little girl is looking at that camera like, I can do this too. And then there's a little boy, like I'm assuming it's her brother, maybe, I don't know, but they were posed as Michelle and Barack, right? Like, and there's that moment, and there's the moment, we see that moment in sports, we see it in music, We see it reflected in so many other spaces. And we wonder, well, that, you know, like, you know, music is very diverse. Well, it is to an extent, right? But there's other aspects of it that are problematic, right? Like the amount of music that has been sort of appropriated. So I think it's just really like this like trying to grapple with this like massive idea that is really unstable. That like, and I mean unstable in the most beautiful sense. Mm-hmm. There isn't one thing. It's so many things, and it's so personal. So I always say to people, like, you know, you have to sort of define what it means for yourself based on where you're coming from, so that you can sort of like enter it that way. And then there isn't going to be a single definition. There's many, and they all live. I know you mentioned the word pluralistic earlier, the pluralistic society, mm-hmm. the pluralistic world, right? Where there's many different universes, if you think, all coexisting. And it's an idea that comes primarily from the global South. A lot of like indigenous cultures have these ideas that the universe is not this cute little nice clean little line, right? That it actually is this incredibly beautiful, ginormous sort of sphere, bunch of spheres, spaces moving through each other and collaborating and talking and engaging with each other. And that's fine, that's beautiful. Like, and we all need to sort of love that rather than sort of say, well, I need to be reductive and make it into a cute little line. Yeah. Like, okay.
I don't know if this is kind of a confession thing, and I had this with the the episode just 21. We are now here in 22 was with Vera Zacchetti, and I had this again.
I talked to Vera last week.
Very nice. Yeah, it's I had it too. This feeling of wow, what privilege! I mean, that I can see myself in, like, for example, it takes me a bit to step back to critically look at the Bauhaus and all this kind of white canon that comes with it. But as you saying it, I understand how easy it is for me to go into that design thing, because hey, look, there's Philipp Starck, look, there's Konstantin Gritschitsch, yeah. Look, there is, like, name it, and then it works for me because I can do that too. They can do it, I can do it. But imagine all the others that I never had that that much on the screen. Sorry.
It's a really beautiful moment to start to think about. You know, you find yourself as a teacher, as an educator, as somebody who's interested in, like, developing, you know, like developing, like, communities that are, like, value everybody, right? Like and, you know, like, one of the things about teaching in schools, and again, all schools have different varying degrees of, like, sort of diverse or, you know, diversity populations, but, like, thinking about how do I step back? How do I, as a designer with this privilege and all this education, all this knowledge that got imparted in all of us, like, we all have to do it, right? Like, because most of us learned, I think I would argue, is just that same narrative. So, but taking the step back is difficult. Because the reality of it is that we're asking ourselves, you're asking yourself, I have to unlearn. Mm-hmm. And this was something that that bell hooks, I reread Teaching to Transgress 2 summers ago or last summer, I can't remember when it was. And it's a beautiful idea that bell hooks puts forth, right? Like, the idea of unlearning is really difficult. It's really difficult when you work in an academic institution and you're supposed to be the know-it-all. Like, it's really hard for academics to sort of admit, I don't know. I did not read that. And I would argue, I read that when she said, I was like, oh my God. She's like, academics are the last people on the planet that would admit that they don't know something. And it's just complete BS. It's just, they're constantly playing this game of, like, they know so much. It's like, who's on top? I know more words than you do. She's like, that's just so unnecessary. Like, the fact that you can say, I don't know, like, hey, let's have a conversation. Okay, look, I want to talk about this in class. I don't know about it. Who am I inviting in, right? Like, who am I bringing in forth that idea of, and again, like, that idea of inviting or bringing somebody in to have a dialogue, to have a conversation, to give them the space, to seed the space, which would then mean that I put myself in the position, I don't know. Like, I'm going to learn too, right? Like, you're no longer the teacher, you're the student, right? And I think that that's really important, but it's really hard to do. It's really hard for humans to do. Any human that has achieved whatever 2% of whatever we all have achieved, it's hard to say, well, I don't know. But I think one of the things COVID is finally allowing us the space to do is to, like, stop posturing and pretending like we know it all. I don't. I mean, I tell my students, here's the deal. I don't know it all. Some of you know some stuff more than I do. And we can engage together and you're going to teach me some stuff and I'm going to teach you some stuff. And it's actually not even teaching you. It's just sharing. Like, it's just sharing a perspective or a way of working or sharing some material that I know or sharing some materials that I engage with. Or here's a reading that I think would be amazing for you. Like, for you as an individual student, not necessarily here's an essay that everybody needs to know. Like, I was also, I had the privilege of having dinner with the historian Nell Painter, the American historian. And Nell was a professor of history at Princeton University for many years. And then after she retired, she went back to art school to get a degree in painting. And then she went to RISD for her MFA. And she came back and talked. She wrote this book called Old in Art School, like this whole book about, like, what happens when you decide to go back to school in your 60s rather than, like, be the hot flavor thing that the art world loves. And I had dinner with her, and one of the things that it was amazing because, you know, you have this incredible master teacher, you know, and she was talking about, like, the amount of time that she would take to teach individual students. And I was like, oh God, I have so much work to do. She's like, that idea that you're not teaching a group of students, mm-hmm. you're teaching an individual student. So it's a lot of work because you have to think about what do I need to engage with, say, to share with, point to that one student that could unlock the world for them. And it can unlock and give them access and allow them to do the best work they can for them, not like everybody.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's a gorgeous idea.
And I think one key point to that is in, with my very young and short expertise in design teaching is to make them unafraid of asking questions. And that is something that is, that in my eyes is very crucial about design education. And by this also to leave that, as you say, the space of the all-knowing genius that you have to look up to, mm-hmm. and that is something that that has something to do with the hierarchies. But still, right, what right. I learned, and also a bit the hard way, is that that as still you you try to lower all hierarchies and to flatten them,
right?
Still, they are there. So it's still that that in the end, there is one person giving grades, there is one person getting money for doing it, and
right.
So it's something that is as much as we want. And I mean, in the computational design, there's this term of shader. A shader is something that is you have an object that is a cube, but you can give it a shader that it looks like a sphere. And in the way, we cannot have a, let's call it a decolonized flat hierarchy behavior when still we have a cube.
You're talking about the structure. Yeah, the structure hasn't changed. Yeah. Right? Like, so thinking about the structural change, mm-hmm. like a lot of it is, and I mentioned that in the definition, and you know, this is the big sort of, at least in the US, is like we have to attack the structure. Mm-hmm. It's not just like about the pretty sort of like surface gestures. It's like the structural, the critical engagement with that structure and the debunking and the pulling apart of that structure is essential, because if we dismantle everything else but not the structure, we're not going anywhere, because it will just come right back to its own way.
But can you explain the structure? Because that is something that I'm very interested to, because from my very European perspective, I don't really get the structure. I see all the misjustice, or how you call it, like all the imbalance of inequalities and all that stuff. But what is the structure behind it? Where to put the
rod in? Let me try my best at that. That's like the first time. So thinking about, so for example, if you think of the laws, for example, in the United States, right, like laws, like incarceration laws, that example, right, like, so in, the way that the incarceration laws in this country have been created in a way that it has created a funnel that most people that are incarcerated are African Americans or Latinos, right, that it's like that structure permeates so much. So you have cities that like are, the jails are packed with men of color, for example. Yep. Yet somehow there are also white people, but they don't end up being incarcerated. So the structure has sort of set up this system, like the jail system. And if you, I don't know if you've ever seen 13th, Ava DuVernay documentary that she made like 2 years ago, she talks about like the capital punishment structure of the United States. Mm-hmm. And how it was set up. So that structure has to be debunked or pulled apart. And that has to do with laws. And that has to do with the way the government was set up, right? Who set up the government, right? How that government was looking at, you know, for example, Black people, right? Like how the founding fathers of this country who, you know, like, oh, the founding fathers. And at this moment, I'm just like, these men were like, yeah, okay, they were smart to a point. They were really problematic people, because they saw Black people not as equals. They saw them as lesser than, and they had no rights, right? So that structure has been built, you can argue, a lot of that has been built into the way that this country has been created, right? And a lot of it comes with sort of like colonialist ideas coming from Europe, because these people were very influenced by Europeans and like that European thought and how the North was seeing everybody else, right? Like how that perspective. So thinking about like a lot of when, at least for me, when I think of the structure, a lot of it has to do with laws. A lot of it has to do with like the foundational root of like a government or the institutions that have sway and have so much power, how that is, right? Like, how do we attack the capitalist structure? What does the structure of capitalism looks like this, right? Like, so we have to get into it to like start pulling it apart because it doesn't work for everybody, right? Like, so how do we make it work? How do we make that structure work? Because otherwise everything else is cosmetic. If we don't really attack the structure, it's cosmetic, right? Like it's cosmetic. It's like you put a little wrap around that makes it look like a globe, but it's actually not. It's just a square still in there. Like,
can we, in design education, can we empower or train students to get on these structural points?
Yeah, and I think a lot of students, I think, at least in my experience, are coming in with these questions already because these questions are outside. Like, I mean, like design can't pretend like it's in its own little bubble and all we do is make little cute posters with like black ink and like cool little letter forms. That's impossible. Like, it, like, you know, like there is a culture, there is politics, there are politics, there are social conditions, there are issues of representation, gender issues, all of these issues impact design. And if we keep thinking that like, oh, well, we just need to learn like how to kern, which, you know, like, let's just kern. It's like, wait, what does that have to do like with, you know, you making a poster for a political march and you have 30 minutes? Like, can I just say that? And I know that that's like a very reductive example to give, but like, I think a lot of the times, you know, we talk about like, oh, design is really political. It's political for the things that the majority has decided is political, right? Like, but what happens, what are the politics have we ignored and have we sort of like performed that we're interested in, but we really are not? And I also think that, I think students are, particularly now with social media, they're coming in more informed and they want to ask these questions. They're being critical, which is just boils down to asking questions. I mean, we started talking about asking questions at the beginning. It's just like, hey, I have some questions, but we also need to get to the point is like, you can ask questions in a thoughtful, generous manner to engage in conversation. That doesn't mean that you need to, you don't need to pretend like you're asking this like, you know, world shattering question. Like, I think we have put too much emphasis on people asking these like earth shattering questions when it comes down to just like, just be a 4-year-old. Like, just be inquisitive. Just ask why. Why can't I do that way?
Yeah, but do we come with that question of asking why to tackling these fundamental inequalities that are like written in a constitution in a way? And you know, like that is something that that I'm very interested in because like having, as you say, that kind of being political, I mean, yeah, like being universal, it's like something that is like a buzzword, like a shell for everything, everything pretentious in a way already. And, but yeah, but just like an engineer, like an engineer from the engineering mindset, like that weird engineer mindset that is going, okay, there's A, there's B, and there's the most shortest direction going there that is the right way. Mm-hmm. So going like deep in and getting this done and having like redesigning let's call it a political system or a participatory democratic process, is something that is super, 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 super complicated, and in my eyes, comparable to engineering. Well, what a European mindset, but still. And my question is: can we, as design educators, enable our students to go into these processes to redesign them for being adaptive to like a pluriverse, like to many people, not to, you know what I mean? And can we get this done? How can we get this done? That is the question.
I think the short answer to it is yes, we can do it. I think the doing is difficult, but the doing requires a lot of honest conversation and a lot of honest discussions with each other, with the students, with ourselves, with the field, with the communities that these students are interested in engaging with. And again, it's just small gestures that you know, start to multiply, fractalize, or go outwards, right? Like that, maybe, like, you know, it's just the idea of, like, I keep thinking the idea of small and slow, and the idea of slow movement that has been really, like, since COVID. That idea is just incredibly beautiful because we've been rushed. Everything's fast. Everything's immediate. Everything's like right now. I need it right now. Like, I want it right now. And maybe part of that speed has just cornered us into this. And I'm like, okay, slow it down.
No shortcuts. I made me note. Like I'm like in my mindset already. When I was just like making this thought loud, was like, okay, where's the shortcut? Where is
right? Idea? Where's the shortcut?
And where's the result? I mean, we have internet. Like, where's the result? But
right,
yeah, it's not working that way.
Yeah. How about you slow down? And you reach out to people and talk to people. Reach out, say hello, say, hey, I'm talking about this, I'm thinking about this. Anybody has any resources that I can read or something that's not, at least for us in design, that's not design. That's not design, designers solving problems. I sometimes think of, like, we've created more problems as designers than anything else. We haven't solved anything. Like, we've just created a lot of junk. And some of it is just really pretty surfacey looking junk, but it's not necessarily junk that can actually be useful. It's junk that other people come in and be like, oh, look at the junk the designers left. Can we, like, reuse it and repurpose it and, like, do something else with it? And they're usually not counted as designers. They're usually dismissed as not being designers, right? And I think it's like, we as designers need to be willing to sit around a table and really collaborate. Like, and honestly collaborate, get off our egos. Nobody cares about your ego. Nobody cares that we all know how to use some, like, fancy software. Okay, Adobe's not gonna save the world for us. Like, it's just not. But, you know, like, what's gonna save us is, like, we can sit down and have honest conversations with people and try to work together, honestly together. Not just say, oh, I know this skill and I can put it together. It's like, no, like, why do I need to put it together? How about I work with, like, let's work together and let's figure out what we make, which may look totally different from what a lot of our sort of expected notions of what design and good design or whatever that is supposed to be look like. But it may be what we need. Like, maybe we don't need any more, like, minimalist junk.
Yeah.
Like, maybe we, like, you know, like, it's just, maybe we need to move on from that.
But aren't we in a tricky situation here? That we can agree on that idea that it's very important to slow down, to reach out, to talk to people, to give things time to be real. But on the other hand, there is a climate change that is running up to us, and there are collapsing democracies in Europe. Collapsing, well, so they are endangered. There are powers at work that work towards illiberality and towards authoritarianism. Oh fuck! That authority-driven approach of being a society. Right. And even in the US, you have that's how I read it in the news, and that you have this massive divide in between this kind of Trumpism people and that liberal leftish people. So they can't really go together anymore. So do we have the time to slow down?
I think we have to take the time to it, because the other direction was the speed. Look, and then it just ignored too many people. It left many people behind. And when it all said and done, we're talking about dealing with human beings and dealing with each other. Like, it's about people. Like, all the other junk we make, it's irrelevant, because it's all about trying to figure out ways to bridge, to, like, get us together, right? Like, let's have dinner together. Like, somehow, like, we got to figure it out. And I think that there's just been a lot of, at least in the US, a lot of BS, for lack of a better word, that's just been thrown and deflected. And a lot of people, at least in this country, have just been sort of like bought a narrative that is just like, it's a movie. Like, I'm just like, this is a movie. Like, haven't we watched this movie a million times on TV? Like this, like whole, like come up with your own new narrative of like reality that like, you know, that COVID doesn't exist, that this doesn't exist, that that's fake, that that's new. It's like, what is going on here? Like it's, and just a lot of people just have bought into it somehow and have fallen into sort of this trap. But I think we have to give it a chance. And I think that if we don't, and we just go right to like, well, we don't have time, we kind of have to make time for it. Because otherwise, like, again, the three people, the privileged people with the knowledge and blah, 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 will run with it. Mm-hmm. And we'll make another junk. And then everybody, the people that are going to get affected seriously over a climate crisis are not the privileged, middle-class, wealthy people of the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
We're gonna build houses and stilts and elevators and fly up and be okay. It's actually, exactly. It's going to be the people that in the global South that are not going to be able to build a house on stilts. And by the way, the people in the global South that have a lot of money will also, guess what, get on a plane and end up here with the rest of us. So we're just going to like perpetuate this thing all over again. So I think part of what I mean by the slowness of it is just being more thoughtful about it and taking more time. And I think with a lot of students, the, you know, like the speed of academia is like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. But I think, I know we've been, in one of the classes that I co-teach at RISD with some of my colleagues, it's called this class called Design Studio 3. And we decided to slow the projects down and give the students more time. And usually at the beginning, the first studio that I, for the last 2 years, I've led with my colleague, Kelsey Elder, the students are going to like, kind of like, go like, what's going on? Like, I don't know what to do in the week two, mm-hmm. because it's kind of the first time where they're given a month to make a project. And they're so used to like, I need to have it done by tomorrow or it's due next week. And I'm like, why do we need to go at this pace? Why do we need to model that? Why don't we just, you know, like allow the students, give them the sense that they can expand and contract time in their practice and that they should be comfortable working in either or, because the reality is some of them have to because of finances. The reality is some students have to go work, and I totally acknowledge that. And the position that I've put myself in is in many ways I'm in a very privileged position, but I was also the student. I didn't come from a wealthy background. I have tons of student loans. So when I hear students in the student loan discussion in the US, I'm like, yeah, you want me to show you my bill?
What is the student loan?
So, you know, education in the US is very expensive. Mm-hmm. So, it's total debt. And when you go to school, most of us, especially most kids that come from not wealthy families, will take out a lot of loans and debt. So you graduate and 6 months later, you get this nice, lovely little letter mm-hmm. that shows you how much money you owe after you've gotten this, like, privilege, amazing thing called an education. And you know, that's very contentious because it puts a lot of people on a path towards never being able to rise or achieve you know, sort of a more stable future. You know, it leads to a lot of people, even people that don't graduate from college in this country, sometimes they can't get that far because they are saddled with this debt. So, you know, but a lot of students have to go work because you got to pay that every month. And usually it's depending on where you went to school and what you studied and all of that. You know, if you studied medicine, if you studied law, you could argue that you see it in the future that you'll be able to pay it off, right? But yeah. People that do social service work, you know, the education is very expensive. They don't get paid a lot of money. So, you know, you're going to come in for like, you're going for 30 years of paying, right? So you usually have like maybe a mortgage and then you got student loans. So the reality is a lot of students have to, you know, pay for that.
Yeah, and they have to work. Quick.
And they have to be quick and they have to go work at places that like sometimes, like they have to go work at Google and they have, because Google pays really well. And, you know, like, I don't tell students, I don't want you to, like, you can't work at Google or a big corporation, because the reality is, you know, like, you may need to work that job for 3 years, and you know, I'm doing this for 3 years because I'm paying it off. And then I'm going to jump and do what I want to do. But I can't do what I want to do. It's not sustainable for me to do what I want to do and be able to eat and be able to have a place and be able to, like if that means, like, I can have dinner with a friend every once a month. You can't do that unless, you know, I do that job. So I'm going to go do it. So I think it's important for us to also remember as teachers that, like, you know, students come from many different backgrounds. And sometimes, like, our desire for them to, like, engage in design with the world in a very particular way can be problematic for some students. You know, it's also, like, thinking about teaching students that come from different cultures and different countries and saying, let's be critical, when in reality, some students come from places where being critical is really it's really endangering their lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we're like, well, you can't be critical. What's going on? You don't know. It's like, no, they're trying to figure out, what does this mean for me now? Because it's always meant that I can't ask questions. I can't ask questions to people in authority. I come from a country that doesn't happen. So it's, again, it's about having those conversations and sort of establishing sort of this wonderful space of trust and like allowing for things to slowly simmer out rather than like, it's gotta be done now, right? Like, and also students realizing that, like, at least for us, it's like, the stuff you make in class might be a seed of an idea that you can develop in another class, or that you can take it as your final project, or that final project that 5 years later, when you are out there as a designer, you finally realize, oh, that's what I wanted. That's what I was thinking about. Like, you don't have, it doesn't get finished in school. It's like, it's not. So that's a long-winded answer to that. But
yeah. As you say the word finished, we are over an hour, and still we are not in TV where we have like fixed broadcasting hours. Still, I want to keep it not more than so much. Still, first, I want to thank you, Ramon, for that very inspiring talk. And I learned a lot, and I feel very encouraged to keep on asking. And don't feel ashamed to, like, it's okay to see the privilege and to work it out. And the last words are for you, as in the tradition in this podcast. So you're closing this down with a last statement. Still, you had a last statement, but
I mean,
give another one.
All right. Thank you, Christian. It's great. I hope people that listen to this, if people have questions and want to engage in the conversation, for people to reach out. I think it's important for all of us to continue having these conversations and to just be open about it and, like, realize that, you know, like, we're just all trying to, you know, make work and sort of have good lives, or whatever that means to you, whatever that may mean to you. But we're also, like, in this weird moment of a pandemic and realizing that, you know, like, there's a lot of people that are suffering and a lot of people have died. I mean, in the United States, the numbers are insane. And just, you know, take a moment, slow it down, you know, read something you haven't read, you know, or reach out to somebody that you haven't reached out to in a while, or, you know, take a little moment to sort of, like, just be like, wow, yes, a lot of us are very privileged to be able to do what we do. We're not first responders. We're not nurses. We're not doctors. And, you know, give those people some major, major credit right now all over the world who, like, you know, who have been doing some insane work, which, you know, like, we just pencil and pixels and, you know, just keep asking questions, and no question is stupid. Like, every question is totally valid. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. That's what I would say right now. Cool. There's a lot of thoughts coming through my head in this conversation. It's fabulous. So thank you for asking the questions, Christian. Definitely. Als ich zur Schule ging, ging das ziemlich schief. We don't need no. Das ist so, hurra, hurra. Der Design Podcast der Burg.